10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering online a master's degree in health and wellness management. Learn advanced wellness program management skills and make a difference in a rewarding career in partnership with UW Extension. Details at uwb.edu.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we're doing something a little bit different and interesting today. We're going to be talking with Jocelyn Fish, and that in and of itself is not exactly unremarkable because she's been a guest any number of times to talk about the Racine Theater Guild in her capacity as development director. But today, Jocelyn is joining us not to talk about the Racine Theater Guild, but rather to talk about a really interesting, nearly unique experience that she had roughly a week ago when she was one of the participants in President Joe Biden's first town hall as president. And of course, that event took place physically in Milwaukee. And Jocelyn played a role in that event. And I know a little bit about the ins and outs of how that happened, but we're going to learn more about that through the course of this conversation today. So, Jocelyn Fish, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Hello, Greg.
Thanks for agreeing to do this. So, take us back to the outset of this whole experience. I would assume at some point you learned about President Biden's town hall meeting that was going to be taking place in Milwaukee, and I assume you came across some kind of opportunity for citizens to be part of it. Tell us how this opportunity presented itself to you.
Sure, that's almost actually exactly what happened. The news broke, I think, about 2 weeks ago now at this point, that CNN was going to be hosting a town hall with President Biden in Milwaukee. And I had actually seen the Theater Guild had been rented several years ago for a Paul Ryan town hall that was also hosted by CNN. And I had seen how people actually got to participate in that, because I actually didn't know. You know, I thought they just like called up random people and, or, you know, had a list of people that they thought would be good participants and asked them to join. Well, actually, you, as a citizen, if you do some Google searching, you can find typically a form or a document or something like that to fill out and submit an application. So I did that. I did a quick Google search just to see if I could find it. I did. So they asked, you know, who I was, what I did, who I voted for, if I was Republican, Democrat, Independent. And then I got to submit three questions. And so that was actually the hardest part of the application process, because, you know, there's so many questions that you could ask in that moment, especially him only being a month into office. And there's a lot happening in our country right now that's a lot of people have questions on. So I submitted my three questions. I thought, oh, I'm not going to hear anything. And then all of a sudden, the Sunday night before the CNN town hall, I got a phone call saying, hey, we've selected you. We'd like you to ask this question that you submitted. You cannot talk to the media or put it on social media or anything like that prior to. Mostly so that the president doesn't know what's going to be asked of him that night. You know, it is a call. They want it to be a good discussion. So I went in on Tuesday and and there I was.
Before we talk about Tuesday night, take us inside that moment where you are pondering what questions potentially to ask President Joe Biden. I hadn't really stopped to think about it, but it is sort of an intriguing and almost kind of awkward situation to find yourself when it is so soon in a given president's term. So what kinds of things did you think about, or what was that process like, besides being, as you just said, pretty difficult?
Yeah, that was really interesting to kind of think about. And, you know, in the scheme of things, the question I ended up asking was much more than about myself. And that was one thing I tried to keep in mind as I was trying to think of questions. You know, it's not only about, it wasn't about just what I was thinking about. I was trying to think of, you know, things that a lot of people had interest in. So the questions I actually ended up submitting ended up being kind of related to me, but also very kind of a broader spectrum. So one of them was actually based around arts funding and COVID relief arts funding, which makes sense because, you know, I work for the Racine Theater Guild, and that has been something from the federal government up until about a month or two ago. There was not much arts funding going out, and there's a lot of organizations that are still shut down due to the pandemic and will continue to be shut down. So that is a concerning factor for a lot of people. Another question I submitted, I'm a very, very, very big proponent of voting. I have voted in almost every election since I turned 18. And so my other question was actually on voter suppression and how we might be able to overcome voter suppression, especially after such a contested election on different sides of it. And then, of course, my third question, which I ended up asking, was based around the idea of student loans, because that is such a, I'm a millennial who went to college, you know, graduated, I'm paying my loans, but I see the way that student loans have impacted so many friends, and especially looking at the pandemic and how it's impacted them and what it will do after that too. And it's a really big point right now, even before Tuesday's discussion where it re-exploded, the really big point of student loan forgiveness has started to kind of bubble up. And I think it's a good time to talk about it because a lot of people are looking for that relief. So,
We're talking with Jocelyn Fish, who's a development director for the Racine Theater Guild. But today we're talking about her participation in President Joe Biden's town hall meeting in Milwaukee just over a week ago on Tuesday evening, February 16th. So you've already touched on the fact that you submitted these three potential questions. You heard back from them, and we're going to, in fact, be one of the people posing questions to President Biden. And I can't remember, when you were told that you do get to participate, were you told which question was going to be yours to pose?
Yes, I was. And I actually had to verify as well that it was I submitted that question, that I wrote it and I submitted it, which I think is a way of them trying to, you know, make sure that there's not outside parties influencing you or things like that. So I had to verify both when I got selected and then when I actually got there in person, I had to sign a sheet verifying that I was the one that wrote and submitted the question. So,
What kind of a gauntlet was it just to get in the building and be seated?
That was really cool. You know, so the way that they posed that I was attending, they said, here's this question, you may have a chance to ask it. So really in that phrasing, I'm probably not gonna ask it. But being in the room with President Biden and Anderson Cooper was hosting that night, I was like, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. So, you know, we had our special parking area. There were protesters, of course, outside. They had part of the block of the Pabst Theater Group blocked off. You know, it's a big deal. he's running the country, he's gotta be protected. You know, we went through our security. Everyone was wearing, there were about 50 to 75 people in attendance, probably total between us in the audience and then the crew members and things like that. We were all handed N95 masks and sat socially distant seating. So once you arrived, they had your seat set up for you and you got to go sit there and get a physical copy of your question, which was really nice because obviously I probably would not have been able to remember it. Hmm. And they kind of prompted you of, here's this X that you'll stand on when it is your time to ask a question. And then we were ready to begin and off and running.
Wow. So how was it then at that point in the town hall that it became your turn to ask a question? I mean, how was that conveyed to you?
So most of the cameras obviously were facing up towards President Biden. I was actually sitting in the front row. So he and I think I became a point of reference for him. I felt like we made a lot of eye contact. And so suddenly I had a tap of my shoulder, and that was your signal to go stand in the spot. And, you know, I was nervous, excited leading up to it. You know what you're going to ask. You have the question, but, you know, you're on TV with literally millions of people watching them. You get to talk to the head of the country, and hopefully have an open discussion. You know, hopefully he says something that it piques your interest and really does answer your question. So once I was standing at that X spot, I just, that's where I tried to breathe a couple times and just get ready to ask a question, to have a conversation. And then I did get to ask. So that was really quite something. And, you know, asking the direct question was something to the tune, if I remember correctly, of student loans are crushing my family, friends, and fellow Americans. How can we live out the American dream when the only option for going to college is student loan debt? Your administration has proposed $10,000 forgiveness, but we need $50,000 forgiveness. What will you do to make that happen? And he had a very direct answer right in his pocket, ready to go. And his first sentence out was, "I will not make that happen," which was quite something to hear. He had his backup reasoning and things, but I think that very direct response and the way that the student loans have started to be talked about and forgiveness has started to be talked about, it really ended up sparking. That was the question you saw on the news for the next like two or three days, which was a little surprising.
Right. Yeah. I should think that your reaction to his answer, I'm guessing, but please correct me if I'm wrong, would be kind of an interesting mix of disappointment that he doesn't quite see this issue the way you do, mm-hmm. maybe coupled with admiration for the fact that he was as frank as he was. Because of course, what we're used to, and I don't just mean from his predecessor, but just in general from politicians, we're used to a lot of tap dancing and spin and not speaking clearly mm-hmm. And without apology, a position that's not going to be popular with some people. So I don't know. Did you have that kind of mixed reaction to his answer?
That's almost exactly what I felt. Just to have an administration that is open to having conversations and open to having town halls with public people asking questions was really astounding and almost a culture shock in a way. Some of the questions prior to me, there was a mom and her young 8-year-old daughter who got to ask a question together, and he directly talked to the 8-year-old daughter. You know, another mom who's trying to get a vaccine for her son, and he wanted to get her contact info to try and help her. So, you know, it was really, there was a lot of human side to the whole evening. And then when it came time to my question, and yes, he did answer in such a direct manner, it was really quite surprising. But I do think that helped spur the conversation forward. Because again, it was, I can't tell you the number of people that reached out to me and said, "I saw you on Lester Holt last night. I saw you on MSNBC. I saw my friend teaches in Japan and her students asked me about this question that you asked." And it just crazy. I think that his really direct response really kind of woke some people up, and you can't just expect people to do what you hope they will do when they're in public office. I think a lot of people now have actually contacted the representatives and their senators and things. So I really didn't know that I was going to spark so much.
That's true. Well, first of all, it from the sounds of it, you framed the question very, very well. And I say that as someone who asks questions for a living. But also the fact that the directness of his answer mm-hmm. Was so much more of a spark than a highly kind of equivocating answer that didn't yep. really say anything, that wouldn't really spark anything. And so the clarity of your question, the clarity of his answer, that's when you get a spark. And mm-hmm. so it is exciting to see, you know, whatever people think about this particular issue, it's exciting to see a discussion of an important issue ignited like that. What was it like to sit there for the rest of the time? Was your heart beating, or were you just cool as a cucumber from that point on, once your moment in the spotlight was over.
Yeah, so I actually ended up being the last question of the evening.
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, so that was really interesting to end on that note. And then it was he and Anderson got to kind of banter a little bit about what it was like living in the White House. So it was kind of like a nice casual end to the evening almost. So they actually ended up filming. He did stay on stage for a very brief moment. You know, obviously you couldn't go shake his hand or anything because of COVID precautions. He did end up getting that mother's contact info so he could contact her and all that. It really did not hit me what had just happened until I got in the car and I was driving home. And I actually called my parents and I said, did you see it? And my mom, and they're like, everyone's reaching out, everyone's texting us. I can't tell you how many notifications I had on my phone. I've heard from people I haven't heard from in years. I said on the way home as I was driving over the home bridge, which was lit up red, white, and blue for his stay. I was like, I can't believe that just happened. That happened.
I don't remember if you said this earlier, but just how thick was the veil of secrecy ahead of Tuesday night's event? I mean, I know you said you were absolutely forbidden from making any mention of this whatsoever on social media and so on. I mean, what else were you forbidden from doing in terms of telling anybody about this?
Mostly just, it's very specifically, it said social media and talking to the media was the two things. I personally just wanted to, I think more to not psych myself out too much, keep it kind of close to me. My boss knew here, and then my family, my immediate family knew. That was pretty much it. Also, you know, I didn't want to like hype it up, and then all of a sudden I didn't get to ask the question. You know, I'd say, oh, I'm going to be on TV.
Right, exactly. Good point. And it's interesting to think, I mean, I have no idea how these things work, but because you were the last question, it's also possible that if things had not unfolded as they did time-wise, maybe you would have been, in a sense, the first one not to actually get to ask a question. So it was maybe a close call that you got to pose your question. And, of course, all of us who know you are really glad that you did. A last question. You've already mentioned the fact that a similar sort of town hall occurred at the Racine Theater Guild. And so you were privy to a lot of those preparations. You kind of knew, in a sense, what was going to unfold. Did this have any significant surprises for you, given the fact that you have actually seen one of these, in a sense, from backstage before?
Yeah. I think more, you know, obviously, this is the first thing I've attended with more than, besides going to the grocery store, with more than like 20 people at it in a very long time. So that was really intriguing. And just to sit in the theater, first of all, during this time was really interesting. There was a whole different feeling of significance with this, because again, it's the president, you know, there's such a pull in that term.
Right. Not the Speaker of the House, although that's an important office too, but that's not the same as the president.
Right. And, you know, just knowing a lot of people had a lot of expectations about this administration. They have a lot set that they want changed, with this administration. And so, you know, especially talking about student loan forgiveness, most people agree that student loan forgiveness should happen. You know, obviously there's a lot more that goes into that question, from access to education to the cost of education in general. But, you know, in asking that question in that venue was really interesting, especially when there are so many other issues. There were questions asked about COVID, questions about small business support, questions about racial equality. You know, there's so many hot topics right now that I feel like we want answers now. And I think that's one of the big differences compared to the previous town hall that I had experienced, is that there's a lot set in motion. Like, this is the time to get things rolling. So that was just really cool. They also, you know, there was all the crew there. They had all their cameras, their lights. That's the thing that I can never get over, is how they transform a theater with all the set stuff. And then we did have a commercial break at one point, and about 15 to 20 reporters come like walking real quickly down the aisle and take photos, and then they have to leave again. So that was just really intriguing too, like a drive-by photography moment in the middle of the whole evening. But yeah, it was just a really cool thing to be a part of, and obviously the lasting impression from, again, my question has been quite something to watch unfold over the last week.
Well, I'm so glad that you took some time to kind of tell us the story firsthand. Jocelyn Fish, Development Director at the Racine Theater Guild, but for our purposes today, a participant in President Joe Biden's first town hall meeting, which occurred last week, February 16th, in Milwaukee. Jocelyn, thank you so much. You really were a great storyteller today, and we thank you for posing an important question to the president, and we thank you for your part in sparking a really important conversation, and thanks for being part of the morning show today.
Thanks, Greg.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show trying to separate fact from fiction as we get to know much better one of the most colorful figures from American history, David Crockett, or of course, as most of the world seems to know him more familiarly, as Davy Crockett. But actually, one of the things we learned from Michael Wallace's very interesting new book is that, as far as we know, he always signed his name David Crockett, hence the title of the book, David Crockett, The Lion of the West. And he was a Tennessean through and through, born in 1786. And before he came to his demise at the Alamo, he actually lived a very, very interesting, colorful, and somewhat complicated life at a time when America was growing by leaps and bounds in more ways than one. And in some respects, at least, David Crockett personified some of the ways in which America was finding its footing as a young, energetic nation finding its way in the world. This book is published by W.W. Norton and Company, and we have a few minutes to speak with its author, Michael Wallace, whose previous books include Route 66 and Billy the Kid, among many others. This book, again, called David Crockett, The Lion of the West. Michael Wallace, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, I am delighted to be with you this morning.
I wonder if you would share with our listeners the really charming story that begins the book in something which you call the personal introduction. It's ahead of the preface, and I think it's so intriguing and entirely appropriate that you titled this bit of writing as a personal introduction. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way. Many others do as well, and I did think it was the best way to start the book to explain my first meeting, if you will, with Mr. Crockett, and it came like it did for so many others, especially from the ranks of the boomer generation. It came for me, the first meeting, on a cold December night in 1954 in St. Louis, where I grew up, when Mr. Crockett, in the form of a gangly former Marine from Texas named Fess Parker, leaped out of my parents' black and white RCA Victor TV right into my lap as I sat cross-legged on the living room floor. And I was, as I say in the book, a goner. He immediately became one of my heroes, as he did for many, many others. And we relished every moment of the three-part Disney series. We all got the ubiquitous coonskin hats and all the other 3,000 items of merchandise that resulted, and sang that famous ballad at the top of our lungs, believing every word was true, that he did kill a bar when he was only 3 and so forth. And of course, later in life, I learned that none of those lyrics were true. So it was a great boyhood story. It was great for boys and girls of the 50s, but it was time to tell the adult story. We know about the Davy Crockett of myth. It was time to tell the authentic story of David Crockett of reality. And we find it a much more interesting and sometimes mysterious story.
You write in the preface, this book is for those people interested in learning the truth or at least as much as can be uncovered, about the historical and fictional Crockett and how the two often became one. You are pointing there to what has to be a fearsome challenge for you or anyone studying David Crockett, and that is that matter of separating the real man and what he really did and really said and really thought from the myth that surrounded him, a myth which he himself helped to construct.
Yes, it is always a tough chore to separate myth and reality, and of course I've done it in the past with other colorful figures from American history, Pretty Boy Floyd and Billy the Kid and others, and that seems to be the niche I've carved for myself as a seeker of true and genuine figures. And it was quite a task with Crockett, as you may imagine. There have been many, many books written about him. However, there are only a few that are really quite good, and most only focus really on the last few weeks of his life, which is a shame, because although they were important, the last few weeks of his life, he was in Texas, and obviously met his demise and the final assault at the Alamo. But there's so much more. He spent most of his life in Tennessee, and he spent a great deal of his time in elected office in Washington, or as it was called back then, Washington City. He toured some of the great cities of the eastern United States, and he did leave his mark. So I wanted to tell the complete story of the boy, of the man, and even those who came before him.
Tell us to what resources you turned and what resources were especially helpful for you towards that end.
The first thing anyone interested in telling or retelling or researching Crockett should turn to, in my opinion, are his own words. And with just a bit of caution, Crockett was the consummate storyteller. It served him well, especially when he ran for political office. He had a great style, a great deal of old country horse sense, a lot of wit, and he told stories upon stories, and of course, with every good storyteller, with each telling, the story gets better. But when he wrote his own narrative, his own autobiography, when he was in Washington, with the help of Thomas Chilton, a friend of his, and another congressman, this one from Kentucky, he really was able to stay pretty much on target. There are a few factual inaccuracies which are fairly easy to ferret out in the book, in his narrative, but it really is the way to go. And I turn to that book, and because you actually get the voice of Crockett. That was very important to me. And of course, as always, the research process is long, sometimes tedious, but it can be so satisfying when you make those great discoveries. And I was able to make discoveries. I was able to identify and describe for the first time a sister of Crockett's who was lost. Like Crockett, later in his boyhood, this young woman was indentured out by their father, who was constantly in debt, but she was lost in the mist of time, and we were able to find her. Those are great little victories. We were able to ferret out in a dusty old archive in Knoxville the copy of Ovid's Metamorphosis, translated from Greek into schoolboy English, which we had heard about, and alas, we did find it, with Crockett's name in it, his notes, and we knew that he had read that book in preparation to write the story of his own Metamorphosis, and that was a memorable day when that happened. So we had all sorts of little surprises along the way that certainly kept me going and in pursuit of the real story.
One thing to note about his childhood is the fact that his father, John, I believe of his name, had plenty of struggles and never ultimately achieved much in the way of worldly success or wealth, far from it, and that in some respects, David Crockett ended up being an echo of his own father. I mean, that ultimately when it came to those such matters, he had plenty of struggles of his own. Could you just draw that parallel for us for a moment?
It's very true. David Crockett, unfortunately, received those genes from his father and proved to be not very wise in the ways of finance or just running his own personal life. Both these men were plagued with disasters, some of them many disasters, some of them much greater, as they struggled on the early frontier of America. For example, both of them, Crockett's father and later in his adult life, Crockett, tried to operate a mill, grist mills. And in both cases, both of them were lost in natural disasters and catastrophes, washed away. But they kept trying. Certainly his father did, but to even a greater extent, Crockett did. He tried to reinvent himself and was successful many times. First and foremost, his best skill was at hunting. He was without question, a crack shot. And he enjoyed hunting. He wasn't a sport hunter. He was hunting to put food on his growing family's table, to sell the bear meat, and that's what he principally hunted, were black bears, although I must tell you, he didn't kill one when he was only three. He did, however, slew 105 black bears one season. He was very successful at hunting, and so his family never was wanting, but yet, because of his wanderlust, because of his need to be out in the woods and the canebrakes and later to spend time in Washington, he proved to be a rather poor husband and father. He was not abusive. He was full of love and respect for both of his wives and his big brood of kids, but he was just gone all the time. And that was his nature. He was gypsy-footed. So you have a man who's very multifaceted in this struggle to achieve some sort of success. As briefly as a militiaman, where he got his fill of war under Andrew Jackson and wanted nothing more to do with it after witnessing the atrocities committed against the Creek people. He was a great hunter. He proved to be an incredible storyteller and a very interesting political figure, both in the Tennessee legislature and later in his terms in Congress. And it was easy to seize upon this man, this Lion of the West, as the subtitle of my book and the name of a great play that came out in his lifetime, loosely based on his life. He became great fodder for the early what came to be called dime novelists, for journalists, and for the producers of the almanacs, the great books filled with exaggerated tales that came out in his lifetime and continued for 20 years.
At some point in the book, you describe him as arguably America's first celebrity hero. Tell us when that began to occur in his life and by what means. I mean, was it, for instance, primarily through these almanacs that you just mentioned, or by other means did he become this sort of legend in his own time?
Well, yeah, it was really, to put it succinctly, all of the above. Some of it was certainly of his own doing, but much of it was from outside forces and influences. There's his great narrative, his story, which was published in which he toured primarily the big eastern cities with and promoting Philadelphia, Boston, New York, and elsewhere. There was the big play in his lifetime I just mentioned, The Lion of the West. But others also wrote books about Crockett and claiming that they were written by Crockett also. And that causes a great deal of confusion because Crockett didn't write those books. And these are the ones filled with exaggerated tales and yarns. There's also his status. He was a man from the soil, from the earth. He was a common man who rose up to some prominence. So he was really one of the first from those ranks to serve in Congress. Many of our political leaders, starting with the founding fathers on up, including Jackson, who rather tried to fashion himself as a populist common man, was actually from the landed gentry. But here was a fellow that people on the rough and tumble folks on the frontier could identify with. He was one of them. He passed the horn of whiskey around. He gave them twists of tobacco at political rallies. And he told a good story. And you could trust him. You could look him in the eye. And you knew he meant every word when he quoted quite often his great motto, always be sure you're right and then go ahead. Yeah, he was a perfect target for mythmakers.
Well, and partly to his own, from his own doing, in a sense, it wasn't just people made this leap of imagination and elaboration. You write at one point, one of Crockett's favorite ploys, developed early on in his political career, was to campaign in a buckskin hunting shirt with two large pockets. In one pocket, he kept a big twist of tobacco, in the other, a bottle of liquor. He went out of his way, at least to some extent, to differentiate himself from others in political life, a more typical stature.
Exactly. No, there's no question about that. And I must say, when he was out on the stump, literally, campaigning for state office and later national office, and winning, he very seldom stuck to the issues. Something that politicians do a little more smoothly today, but he was quite blatant about it. When he got up to speak, he usually told them good stories, something they wanted to hear, something either out of reality or out of his head. And he had this great self-effacing sense of humor. He wasn't afraid to turn it around on himself. And I must tell you, there's no question, we have evidence of this, that he had a great impact certainly on many, many, many people throughout the years and generations. But we know for sure he had a direct impact on three other important Americans, Mark Twain, Abraham Lincoln, and Oklahoma's own Will Rogers. All of them had that same down-home humor and sharp wit and were not afraid to make themselves the brunt of the joke.
For all the ways in which he was an uncommon member of the U.S. Congress, I mean, maybe like none that body had ever seen, he was not particularly effective when it comes to getting anything passed. You tell us, in fact, in his three terms in the U.S. Congress, he never got a single piece of legislation passed. Explain the root of his ineffectiveness in this regard.
Well, no, he didn't get not a one passed. His commonness, so to speak, his lack of formal political training worked against him. He had that native horse sense, which guided him well and served him well and helped him get elected. But he didn't prove effective in Congress. He was a great storyteller, yet he certainly didn't become a noted orator like Clay or Webster or Calhoun, and he didn't have the power of those men who were really early professional politicians and had been honed in on that particular occupation from being young men throughout their whole lives. He also would be distracted very easily and didn't spend a lot of time in Congress. He was trying throughout his career to push for a land reform bill to gain more land for his constituents, for those folks out on the frontier as it moved further west with every passing day, and the early stages of what about 10 years after Crockett's death became known as Manifest Destiny, the seizing of the land. And there, even ironically, he opposed his former political mentor, Andrew Jackson, over Indian removal, because he had witnessed these atrocities in the Creek War, and he told Jackson, look, we have bothered these people enough. These five tribes of the Southeast, don't move them off their land. And Jackson wanted to. He wanted to move them where I am now residing, in Oklahoma, Indian Territory, on the Trails of Tears. And there were many watery Trails of Tears and overland. And Crockett stood up to him, and he was sure he was right, and he went ahead. But it also displeased a lot of his constituents who wanted land, wanted more land. It cost Crockett his job in Congress, but he could live with that, even though he was the only member of the Tennessee delegation to vote against Indian removal, and he was quite outspoken. But it cost him his job in Congress and truly, ultimately, his life.
Hmm. You tell us in your book about some of what was written about David Crockett, much of it untrue, and which helped inspire him to pen his own autobiography, that was one of the things which really had distracted him from his congressional duties in that last term. You also write at some length about this really interesting play, the title of which gives your book its subtitle. Tell us just a little more about this play and how it figured so prominently in the deepening of David Crockett's legendary status among the in the hearts of so many ordinary Americans.
Well, the drama is called The Lion of the West, and it emerged in the early 1830s, made its debut in New York. It swept the eastern United States. Eventually, it went overseas and was performed in London under various titles, but basically the same story. And the main character of the story was a frontiersman who was loosely, some say not so loosely, but more direct, based on Mr. Crockett. And he was a colorful character, this fellow, who was dubbed Nimrod Wildfire. Just that name alone was colorful enough. But he was an over-the-top character. He was almost burlesque in his dress, all sorts of fringed buckskin, not wearing a raccoon hat, but wearing a hat fashioned from a bobcat skin, a great big hat. And there's a pivotal moment, which of course I describe in the book, when Crockett, who became aware, as everybody else in the country did, of this play, finally went to see it when it was playing in Washington City. And he went with his entourage to the theater, and no one knew what to expect. Would he like it? Was he angry? Would he leap on the stage and pummel Nimrod Wildfire, or would he accept it? So when he and his folks walked into the theater, Crockett, who, by the way, never wore buckskin and animal skins to Congress. In fact, he very seldom wore a raccoon hat. He always wore a big, broad hunter's hat, usually. He went to Congress in a frock coat and silk cravat and pressed trousers like everybody else. So when they entered the theater, they were seated in the first row, and everyone exploded in applause. And then as Nimrod Wildfire leaped onto the stage, everyone waited with bated breath for the reaction. Nimrod Wildfire, his heart must have just been pounding in his chest, walked to the edge of the stage and made a big sweeping bow to Mr. Crockett. And they waited, and after a few seconds, Crockett rose to his feet and made a big sweeping bow back in return. And it was at that moment that myth and reality gently collided.
Your book, of course, finishes out with some clarification of what happened at the Alamo and the circumstances under which David Crockett's life came to an end. We mostly have to leave it to our listeners, of course, to seek out the book and read for themselves. Can you just say a word or two about what you have tried to do in terms of clarifying this final chapter of Crockett's life?
Sure. It won't ruin the book for anyone to tell you that Crockett died in the end of the book. That's no great surprise. But how he died, as you say, is what's always debated. First of all, Crockett spent, as I said, very little time in Texas. He went down there to rebuild his career after he was voted out of Congress. He was expanding his horizons. He wanted to see what it was all about. Sam Houston, his old pal from Tennessee, had told him there was money to be made down there in land speculation. A lot of others were making money setting up a plantation system, bringing in slaves. A lot of Southern Anglo immigrants started as colonists and eventually became illegal immigrants. And they were breaking the laws of the country they lived. They lived in Mexico, and they were to abide by the laws. And the new constitution had abolished slavery, and they kept bringing in slaves. So that was a big part of the problem, and it's why those Texas rebels broke away to continue with their first 10-year republic, and then eventually in 1845 come into the Union as a staunch slave state. Crockett, as we like to say out west, had no dog in that fight. He went down there purely to stretch his legs and see if he could pick up a little money and rejuvenate his career. And he took his own sweet time getting down there. In fact, there were stories, where is the great Crockett? We thought he was coming. Some thought he was dead. Well, he was chasing buffalo herds with Becknell, the father of the Santa Fe Trail along the Red River, or he was hunting honey trees out in the forests of East Texas. But he finally got down there, said he'd like to get some land. They said, sure, sign up for our militia. He did. They sent him to San Antonio de Bejar, and there, on March 6, 1836, at 49 years of age, Crockett died. Some would say he died swinging old Betsy over his head, the last to stand. A few people always believed he dressed as a senorita and became a sniveling coward, something that he never would have done. There were stories that he surrendered. There were stories that he survived for 20 years or more. There were still sightings of Crockett as a prisoner in a mine in the interior of Mexico, or seen on a street, you know. But the fact is, he did die that day. I subscribe to the De La Peña theory. He was a high-ranking Mexican infantry officer who chronicled those times. I think it's the most sound theory that Crockett and a handful of others did not surrender, but were taken prisoner at the end of that siege, of that assault, and were taken before Santa Anna, who, and De La Peña and others petitioned for leniency for Crockett, who they called the great naturalist. And Santa Anna said, no quarter. We were giving no quarter today, and no quarter will be given. And he was summarily executed. And like all the others, their bodies were burned. And I think that's probably the best and most logical ending. The whole point is, however he died, we do know he died that day at the Alamo. He, David Crockett, but Davy Crockett rode on.
The book is called David Crockett, The Lion of the West, and the book is published by W.W. Norton & Company. Michael Wallace, I have so enjoyed speaking with you and very much enjoyed your book. I learned a lot, and I know our listeners who seek the book out will learn much and enjoy it as I did. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it is the monthly visit of Ryan Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. We hope that you can join us.